Thanks, Travis, and good evening to everybody present. One of the things for the calendar that Travis just mentioned is that next Lord's Day evening, Lord willing, Josh is going to speak for us. So we'll have several of our young fellows also who will be helping to lead our service, and I hope you'll pray for them and plan to be with us for that activity. I have something a little different for us tonight, and the way we need to approach it, I think it's something that is important and we need to think about. I got started with this when Jason sent to me a few weeks ago an article. Here's the heading of it. Religion is on the decline as more adults check none. And maybe you've seen some similar headline is that to some news article. And this report is that less than half of American adults now attend church regularly, some 45%, and now more than one-fourth, 26%, claim no religious affiliation. And then the article comments this way, religiosity in the U.S. is in sharp decline. And this is a Pew Research Center report. It ranks people who don't adhere to any faith as growing fast while church attendance steeply falls. The report is that about 65% of the U.S. population now is Christian in their mindset, and that's down from 77% in 2009. And those who don't identify with any religion, we refer to them sometimes as the nones, N-O-N-E-S, now make up, as we said, 26%, which is up from 17% only a decade earlier. Seeing headlines like that and reports like that leads many people to think that non-belief is so much on the march that religion in general, and all of these stories will suggest, Christianity in particular, will inevitably fade away. That's a disheartening thing for people who care about the Lord and who believe that God's love and wisdom has the best chance of providing us with hope and meaning in our lives, and certainly has the best means to anchor us in kindness and humanity and justice for our fellow man. One of the things that articles like this lays before us is our need to be able to try to hold out the light of the Word, the light of life, to people in some way that does more than simply argue a disagreement with some other group who already shares the worldview that believes that there is a God and that Christ is His Son. However important those discussions might be, if we're dealing with a mindset which now is none and is content to be none, then how do we proceed? What do we need to do? I'd like to at least ask us to consider two things tonight. One is what John says in John 1 and verse 5. John says, the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. The meaning of that one little statement is profoundly encouraging, the way it reminds us of the power of the light of God's life. The idea that one light can be seen in darkness, and that all of that darkness cannot overcome that one light is an important notion. The word for overcome here gets translated apprehend, as if you capture it, or comprehend, as if you understand it and take it in, or overcome, like this version translates it here. Either way, The idea is that the light is fully able to supply the darkness. And the resurrection of Jesus would be a great example of that. Now, with that in mind, I also would like to ask us to consider some other things that at least belong in this picture where this headline, Religion is on the Decline, is concerned. I'm going to need to quote some things or to share some other articles with you about this more than I ordinarily would to help us to consider the reality that's before us without being overcome by it. The first thing is another headline. This is a headline from the Washington Post, just not very long, not maybe more than 2 or 3 years before. The world is expected to become more religious, not less. Notice the world here. And I call your attention to the fact that this is from the same research organization that did the previous research about the nuns. One of our problems is that we're thinking about Western culture and life in America only and not enough about the overall picture. And the overall picture has some astonishing truths to it. In the non-Western world, the growth of Christianity is something I think that most people are completely oblivious to. And I'm talking about the Christian worldview or belief that Jesus is the Son of God in the broader sense. There are more Christians in that sense attending church in China than in all of Europe. Very few of us would ever guess that. By 2020, Christianity will have grown from about 1.2% of the population in 1970 to about 10.5% of the population in 2020, which sounds like a small thing, except that's growth from 1.4 million or 11.4 million to 171 million. That's quite a change, isn't it? In East Asia, that's the story that I just mentioned, not just China, but in East Asia, China, Korea, Japan, and so forth. Also, in 1910, only 12 million people, or about 9% of Africa's population, would identify as Christian. But by 2020, they'll number 630 million, more than 49% of the population. In South America, a similar story can be told if you care to look about that. In the U.S. then, the growth of the nuns, as we call them, has been mainly among the more nominal in their relationship to the faith. What you don't see is that the devoutly religious in the U.S. and in Europe are growing. About 80% of the world's population finds reason to believe that there is a God, or that the God of the Bible would be Him. And the most striking thing about this headline that would be unthought about, or not thought about unless we stop and do it, is that the demographic studies that predict all of this, that religious populations are declining, tell us that secular ones are the secular population is the one that's in long-term decline. That the religiously affiliated will slowly but steadily decline, unaffiliated, I should say, will slowly and steadily decline from about 16% of the population today till about 13% of the world population 40 years from now. and that the shrinkage of secularism and liberal religion is the one is the decline that's inevitable, and not the decline of religious people. Now, you may wonder why. How could people who study the trends, the social scientists, religious scientists, come to that kind of conclusion? Two main reasons. One has to do with the fact that the trends of retention among religious groups. One of the researchers says that almost all of the new religiously unaffiliated, the ones we would call the nuns, are not from conservative religious groups, but from the more liberal ones. And they call attention to the fact that secularization mainly erodes the taken-for-granted moderate faiths that trade on being mainstream. You think about that. That's one reason for the anticipated decline of the unaffiliated or the secular. The second main reason the world will become more religious is that religious people have significantly more children. The more irreligious and secular a population, the less often marriage happens and the smaller families are. And it's not enough to say, well, it's because the religious ones are less educated or they're more country and less urban. The research shows that even if the religious families move to the urban setting, they still have and raise more children, and in the long run cause that population to grow. Now, another part of this that needs to be considered is that not all of the religious increase or not all the maintaining of the religious population would be necessarily Christian. Even in studies in the U.S., the religious groups that held steady or did not decline were not Christian groups. They would be Jewish or Muslim or other kinds of groups like that. So here's the first thing for us to deal with in our thinking. The world will become more religious and not less so over the next 40 years. A second thing, just a reality that I think gets just overlooked. The nuns, those who move their thinking to the non-belief category, are in the process severing themselves from the living taproot of so many of their own core values. If you listen to secular culture right now and you think about the value of the individual liberty and dignity, and if you think about justice, social justice and righteousness in that way, or if you think about caring for our democracy and so forth, where do you think those values originate, or where do they come from? If you think of some of social values that are treasured by our culture right now, like caring for those who are less fortunate, or the dignity of any race or gender with the rights of each one, or the importance of trying to love your enemy and live with your enemy instead of simply destroying him. Where did all of those things come from? Let me read you a couple of quotes that I have noticed. One from the French philosopher Derrida. He says, "Today, the cornerstone of international law is the sacred. The sacredness of man as your neighbor, made by God or by God made man. In that sense, The concept of crime, of a crime against humanity, is a Christian concept. And I think there would be no such thing in the law today without the Christian heritage. Another one, this quote comes from Jürgen Habermas, who is has a background as a secular philosophy and a highly respected one, who has in more recent years tried to highlight the value of religion. He shocked some of his fellow philosophers. He expresses the growing consensus of many scholars, and he says that the modern ideals of freedom, of conscience, human rights, democracy, come from the Bible's teaching on justice and law, and that secular society has found no good alternative way to ground these ideals. None of us would suggest just get rid of the ideals. The question is, how will they be sustained? How will they be upheld? How will we pass them from one generation to the next? Even in thinking about family, as we did this morning, if you get right down to it, a lot of people in our culture are living on the faith of their grandparents. And what I mean by that is that we're depending on qualities like honor and respect and loyalty, faithfulness, grace and kindness, forgiveness, mercy, in order to function in our families. But our children or our grandchildren don't have any idea why they should honor those qualities or imitate those qualities. We have families who are trying to live by them without a reason to live by them, because they've learned it from a generation or two before. And one wonders, when we talk about Western values, and they're the kinds of things you hear argued in political discussions every day, loudly, but without the thing that anchors those values and motivates them, and it becomes simply loud hollering at each other and not in favor of anything. So here we have a search for religious footing and grounding, untethered from what gave us the values that we treasure to start with. And into that picture comes the push for secularism and science and rationality based in human ability. And the fact is that secular rationality is unable to fill the void that happens when we leave our roots here, and it's capable of furthering the harm. And again, it's astonishing sometimes to listen to the debates that go on in our culture once we've left out what gave us our rights and our values to start with, and to hear supposed solutions to the problems that we face, socially speaking, in our society. I ran across an extended kind of an interview in the footnote of some book that has struck me. It's an interview of historian Karen Armstrong. It comes from November the 23rd of 2014, and it was done in Salon magazine. She's asked, and this is you can tell by the question kind of where the mindset of the interviewer was headed. She's asked if religion isn't, quote, a strain of irrationality, end quote, in our society, And if we shouldn't purge this irrationality wherever we see it. End quote. Now, Armstrong, I don't know what they thought she might say, but she responds that even though communism was said to be a more rational way to organize a society, as she put it, it was based on a myth of the healing state. And though the French revolutionaries were, here's her quote, imbued with the spirit of the Enlightenment, end of quote, and were strongly anti-religious and anti-church, and even talked about the goddess of reason, as she quotes it, they publicly beheaded 17,000 people. And you might have picked up on what she meant about the myth of the healing state with regard to communism, with what happened in countries with oppressive regimes that destroyed the lives of many people. And then Armstrong argues that no one is perfectly rational because science and rationality cannot speak to right and wrong, significance and meaninglessness. Science and rationality cannot ultimately guide behavior beyond telling us what is the most efficient and practical way to reach particular goals, like machinery. They cannot tell us if those goals are good or right. And Armstrong says, therefore, human beings need, quote, the stories we tell ourselves that enable us to subject the kind of ultimate significance, however hard we try to be rational. Now, that's a scholar's way of saying we may trick ourselves into thinking that we only are moved by reason and thought, but we need meaning and goodness and significance, and they don't necessarily come without a story of something greater than ourselves. So she concludes that rationality can't give meaning because it is often the only, and because it's only often the only public discourse allowed, there's been a very strong void in modern culture despite our magnificent achievements. And she says that much of the aimlessness that's behind a great deal of crime and unrest in our culture comes from a lack of meaning, which is a dangerous thing. We're not arguing against the use of common sense and of reason and science and rationality for whatever good it can ever, any of it can ever do. But we do want to stop and be realistic about what it can't do. And that's to say what's good and to give meaning. And where those things are mentioned, are absent, then we end up with much emptiness and evil in the world around us. That moves us to this other thought. When all of that, then, you follow the one step to the next here, where we end up is most of us, I think, knowing that for our lives to matter, there has to be something beyond just what happens here, and knowing that there are things missing from our lives, which when we try to address, we end up knowing that God Himself is at the end of that search, the end of that longing. I've quoted for you recently a friend of Harvard professor James Wood, who said to him, and he's a skeptic himself, how can it be that this world is the result of an accidental Big Bang? How could there be no design, no metaphysical purpose? Can it be that every life, beginning with my own, my husband's, my child, and spreading outward, is cosmically irrelevant? Now, before you pass that off as a quote with big words. Please think about what she's saying. Can I say that the people I love most don't matter? Can I build a family that way? Can I endure hardship that way? Can I overcome challenges that way? Can I aspire to goodness and greatness that way, thinking it does not matter? Most of us know instinctively there's more to it than that. Then the other part of this, the transcendence part of it. I happened to see an article from July of this year. They tried to start a church without God. For a while it worked. And I need to share with you, it's a long article, so please bear with me in the line of thought. I'll skim over it with you. This is about a lady, a 40-year-old young woman, who left her church and her old city and all of that, and ended up in New York City 9 years ago. And then a secular congregation called Sunday Assembly became a part of her life, and for a while filled that spiritual void. Sunday Assembly without God. This is a woman whose parents had no interest in religion, but, listen to this, they sent her to a Christian school in hope of finding good discipline and education. What does that tell you? The young woman became a believer, but by the time she ended up in New York 9 years ago, her faith had been unraveled by overseas travel and the question of how one religious community could have the monopoly on the truth and so forth. And so, telling herself it was for her own good, she decided it no longer made sense to believe. And what she ended up with was a hole in her heart. She missed people, and she missed something greater than herself. So on Sunday, she found out about this Sunday assembly group where members would gather on Sundays and sing together and listen to speaker and converse over coffee and donuts. Sounds a whole lot like church services without God and without a message. There are other groups like this for faithless seekers that want to carry on some aspects of their religious life without the things that made it religious life. The growth of the nuns has revved up this movement. And it started groups like Sunday Assembly or another group similar to this called Oasis. The growth of these groups, however, please listen, has not kept pace with the growth of the nuns. And after a promising start, attendance declined. Nearly half the chapters fizzled out. This writer says building a durable community of non-believers, it turns out, is more complicated than just excising God. But the need in people's heart stays there anyway. The people need to feel part of something bigger than themselves. Meetings of these groups involve sermons, that's in quotes, from scientists, artists, and academics. Members sang pop songs together and snapped their fingers to poetry readings. And old-timers chatted by the snack table and invited newcomers to meals outside that meeting. They started having problems. Here they are. Working long volunteer hours to put each service together led to things beginning to fall apart. Making a congregation happen basically meant putting on a big show on a regular basis. Somebody needed to book bands and find speakers and to set up chairs and to pick up snacks. It took a lot of money. And even within the community of non-believers, there were different groups with different priorities. And there was so much competition for time and attendance on Sunday mornings when the meetings were scheduled. Motivation became a problem. People began to be non-attendees at the meetings of non-believers. Then they began to try to investigate, and they found out that the groups that survived over times were the ones who made the largest number of, had the, required the longest number, or largest number of sacrifices from their adherents. That believers who believed in God are the ones who kept coming together over a period of time and making sacrifices for something greater than themselves, and hence having connections to people who had things greater than themselves. Here's the way the article goes ahead. One of their officials says there has to be a sense of transcendence. Transcendence is what gives the community a higher level of meaning than Johnny's Little League games. I'm thinking about what church means here as I'm reading this. One of the writers says that a leader on one of these groups developed a framework with five core components to help any congregation have that transcendence. Congregation of non-believers. Here they are. One, community life. Two, transformational gatherings. Three, personal growth. Four, helping others. Five, changing the world. I surmise that it's hard to change the world when your message is the world doesn't matter. This writer says it may sound like clumsy marketing speak. It can feel awkward to watch a so-called atheist church work out its evangelization strategy in real time. I would think so. The challenge now, he says, is making a community last beyond its own generation. Organizers hope that other adults will see how wonderful it is to be accepted and accepting, to sing Bon Jovi badly in an abandoned church building, or to hear a talk about quantum physics in a local Y with other like-minded people. I read that parts of that long piece to try to impress on you what I'm getting at here. There not only is the secular unable to fill the void, guys, move to the next one for me if you will, but our sense of something more important than ourselves and of what's missing in our lives requires God Himself. When Paul went to Mars Hill in Athens, he addressed the people and he said to them, "What you therefore worship in ignorance, I proclaim to you." We have to learn in some way or another to take that strategy to talk to the people around us. There is a desire for community. Let's be one. There is the desire for something more important than ourselves. Let's let there be that. And there is an interest in a togetherness that helps to change the world for the better. Let's be that. In John 1, I think John is considering that when he says, "In Him, Jesus, was life, and the life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not put it out," not overcome it. And then verse 12, "To all who did receive Him, who believed in His name, He gave the right to become the children of God." It's my hope and prayer that a place for that kind of message remains in our culture. I suggest that the three beginning phrases in the model prayer be ours daily. Let your name be kept holy. Let your kingdom come. Let your will be done. Are you a citizen of the Lord's kingdom? Does His light shine in you? Is His life your life? It can be. And if you came tonight desiring for that to be the case, if we can help you, please let us know about it while Travis leads us in this next song. If you'd be standing.